If you even remotely enjoy surgery, then I bet that the good old intestinal foreign body removal is high on your list of favorite surgeries to do. Not many things in our job is quite as satisfying and as immediately life-savingly impactful as cutting a corn cob or a stone or a large flesh-colored men's G-string out of a dog's ileum. Yep, that really happened. But where GI foreign bodies become a lot less fun is when you open up the abdomen and you're faced with a very sad, very red, or even worse, purple, bunched up intestinal tract that is so tightly strung that you can't even lift it out of the abdomen. Yep, of course, I'm talking about those lovely linear foreign bodies. Nobody loves making 10 small incisions into the gut to take out 10 small bits of string or sock or flesh-colored undies, or even worse, cutting out large sections of bowel from an already compromised GI tract. Which is why I love this episode with surgeon Dr. Bronwyn Fullagar, which is just filled with nuggets of wisdom on how to make your linear foreign body surgeries easier and more successful. Because the only thing worse than making 10 incisions into the GI tract to take out 10 small bits of string is making any incision into the gut for a round 2 surgery after round 1 has gone to shit. Dr. Bronwyn Fullagar is a specialist surgeon from Australia who practices in the US. She loves sharing her knowledge to help the rest of us become better, more confident surgeons and happier humans. If you want to hear more about Bron and her story and about becoming a specialist surgeon, go back to episode 30 where we interviewed her on the podcast. Bronwyn shares her knowledge through her speaking, writing, and through her role as the Director of Surgical Education for the Veterinary Emergency Group, or VEG, and through multiple episodes on the VetVault Clinical podcast. And this episode on how to make linear foreign body surgery less scary is from the very early days of the podcast, I think back in episode 4. We're currently at episode 150-something on the surgery stream alone, to put that in perspective, and this is still one of my favorites, which is why I wanted to share it with you. If you have not yet checked out our subscriber-only clinical podcast, well, why the hell not? I can only assume that you have not heard about them, so let me tell you more. For our clinical podcasts, I interview specialists and ask them all of the questions that I've accumulated over my 20-odd year career about their topic of expertise, all the stuff that I used to or still get stuck on. So, updates on what's new, or sometimes a revision of important things that I've long since forgotten. You're not going to find these podcasts if you search for them on your podcast player, because access to them is through a paid subscription. Once you sign up for them at vvn.supercast.com, they will show up on your podcast player of choice. Now you might ask yourself, why would I want to become a paid subscriber when Hubert is sharing this stuff on here for free? Well, first, because on our subscriber-only podcasts, we have a vault, get it, of around 450 episodes in small animal medicine, surgery, and emergency and critical care, with 2 new episodes released each week. So the stuff that you hear on here is just a drop in the ocean. Second, subscribers get access to our beautifully crafted, very popular show notes so that you can refer back to the stuff that you've learned on the podcast when you see that case that makes you think, I think I listened to a podcast on this, but I can't quite remember what they said. Our notes have grown into a searchable library for quick reference in its own right, and it's become my personal first line reference when I'm on the clinic floor. This is because it's not just a wordy textbook chapter, it is the up-to-date key tips and takeaways from some of the smartest, most experienced people in the field. Third, members get exclusive access to spaces on the VetVault network where you can ask questions and have discussions about the stuff that we're learning, and you get to help us guide what content gets produced next. And lastly, ads. These public versions of the podcast will usually have some sort of advertising attached to them, like this message, whereas the subscriber feed will never have any ads. So if you like what you hear on this episode and you do want to check out our full feed of clinical content, go and try it out for free for 2 weeks at VVN, that's VVN for vetvaultnetwork.supercast.com. Okay. Dr. Bronwyn Fullagar and linear intestinal foreign body surgery. Welcome back, everybody. We have Dr. Bronwyn talking to us about GI surgery again tonight, but we're diving into a unique one, one that can be a real challenge for most of us. We're talking about linear foreign bodies. Gerardo, you get lots of these, I take it.
We get a lot of these. We get ones which are sent across because clinicians don't want to tackle them, which is perfectly fine. And to be honest, I don't really want to tackle them either because like 40 to 50% of them have perfed already. So you're dealing with septic peritonitis. And maybe that's actually a good point to discuss about your decision-making process between chopping them or not, or referring them or not. But I'm sure that will come up in the chat. Bron's a guru at this stuff. So we're looking forward to hearing what she has to say.
Bron, do you see more complications from linear foreign bodies than you do with other intestinal surgery?
Yeah, and I think that's because, like Gerardo said, they tend to be a bit more challenging than your standard solitary foreign body, in that there's a lot more damage potentially done to the intestinal tract. And yeah, like Gerardo just said, many more of them have perforated by the time you do surgery. And so that means that you need to do a resection and anastomosis. And that's a pretty technically challenging GI surgery. But yeah, I think they can be really manageable. You just need to kind of have a technique or a set of steps that you take with them. So yeah.
Actually, what you just said there was really important about the decision-making process to jump in. So in my mind, if you've never tackled a linear foreign body, or you've never done a resection anastomosis, or you don't have access to someone who's done at least a resection and anastomosis, then I think that, you've got to be either gung-ho and prepared and read up and have a step-by-step process. But otherwise, maybe if it's within referral distance, and maybe in my mind, that would be something you would consider referring.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the main troubles that people find themselves in, is they go in thinking, oh yes, I know this cat ate a piece of string, or I know this dog ate a long piece of carpet, no problem. And then they get into surgery not expecting to have to do a resection anastomosis perhaps. And then all of a sudden they're in surgery, maybe they're by themselves, or they don't have a ton of mentorship, or they're not super familiar with the procedure. And all of a sudden they're faced with one of the most challenging intestinal surgeries, you know, you have to do. And I think that's when things can start to go a little bit sideways. So yeah, definitely rule number one, I think, is if you're going in to cut a foreign body that you suspect is linear, you need to be prepared to do a resection anastomosis. And that might mean having another person scrubbing with you. Would highly recommend that. And also hopefully having practiced it a few times, maybe on cadavers, or you've done a course, or you have a mentor in the practice who's pretty familiar, who can guide you through it. Because it is a surgery that it's pretty difficult to do for the first time if you're just reading it out of a textbook, or you don't have a lot of support in your practice.
So I'll give you a few scenarios that I've encountered that scared the bejeebus out of me. Unexpected, a little bit blasé, and you go in and you meet a few problems, and you can maybe talk us through how to deal with each of these. So the first thing is where it's already damaged the intestinal tract. So you go in and there's this really freaking tight loop of the rope bound or string bound gut that you can hardly lift out of the abdomen. And on the mesenteric surface, you have these multiple little black lines that you just go, oh crap, are those alive or dead? And a big challenge for me there is decision-making, what stays and what goes. The other thing that I've encountered is physically just getting it out, exactly that. Sometimes it's so tight from that piece of linear foreign body that I can't properly lift it out, especially the ones where you have, it's anchored in the stomach. One of my worst ones was a tennis ball that had half unraveled. So it was anchored in the stomach, oh, wow, and then gone all the way through linear foreign body halfway down. So you had the whole duodenum and half the small intestine just bunched up into this tight little friggin' ball. Third problem is access again, is if it is in the duodenum, because you can't lift the duodenum out as nicely as you can lower down the intestinal tract. I've really struggled with some of those where it's stomach anchored and then the duodenum's all bunched up. How do you access that? I feel like there was a fourth, but I'll stick to those three.
Yeah. That's a lot of questions already. I think
you didn't add in any life advice as well in that, mate. So like number five, how do I survive as a human being?
Relationship advice.
Oh, I think I'll stick to linear foreign bodies, but maybe a future episode. So in answer to I think all of those questions can be answered in sort of the series of steps that I would take. So a few key ways that linear foreign body surgery is different to other foreign body surgery for me. And I think one of the first ones that's really important is usually when you do foreign body surgery, we're taught to do a full abdominal explore prior to taking the foreign body out. So, you know, you look at the stomach and the intestines, the liver and the bladder and the spleen and everything. And then after you've done all that, then you start taking out the foreign body. And the linear foreign bodies are entirely different. So if I go into an abdomen and the intestines are all plicated and they're all bunched and I can't move them, I don't even touch the intestines to begin with. The last thing I want to do is start manipulating them and have the string tear through the mesenteric border. So it's really difficult to assess intestinal viability when they're all bunched. So usually number one port of call is identify where the foreign body is anchored and release the anchoring. That's number one. Before you do an explore, before you assess viability, anything else. And so in a dog with your tennis ball analogy, that's most likely going to be in the pylorus. And in a cat, you're most likely to find a string under the tongue. Not all dogs and cats obviously read the textbook, but I would say, especially for dogs, the vast majority of these are going to be anchored at the pylorus. So step number one will be gastrotomy and release the foreign body. So in your tennis ball case, you would cut the piece of unraveling right below the tennis ball and remove the tennis ball, check the rest of the stomach for material, close the gastrotomy and let the fluff from the tennis ball or the string of the tampon or whatever your foreign body happens to be, let that start sliding down the duodenum. So allow it to make its way into the small intestine. And then once you've got the foreign body into the duodenum, the good thing about dog foreign bodies is because they tend to eat carpet, toys, you know, women's hygiene products, all those sort of things, they're pretty easy to feel. They don't tend to eat needles and threads, dogs, as a general rule. Sometimes they do, but usually not. They usually eat something large that you can feel. And so then you can start to milk the foreign body down the small intestine and relieve the plications really gently. And at that point, you've got a much better chance of assessing viability and accessing what you need to access in the small intestine.
Okay, cool.
My experience has been otherwise a little bit, because sometimes I found it pretty hard to get to the stomach. So sometimes the only thing I've been able to do is release the aboral anchor, or you call it anchor, or the aboral kind of bit that's been pushed along. That's given me enough space to kind of unravel it a little bit, take the pressure off, and then get into the stomach. So I've always tried to get the stomach, and sometimes I just haven't been able to like get enough exposure. And then when you get in there, I think one thing that's really helpful is like passing the stomach tube, because often they're full of fluidy stuff that spills everywhere once you start exteriorizing the stomach, or once you start cutting open the stomach. Is there any tips there, I suppose, like for those ones which are bunched up and they're all kind of like a bundle of intestine looking disgusting?
Yeah, I think so my best foreign body, linear foreign body story, the one that I have a big photo of in all my PowerPoints on this topic, is a dog, a Labrador, that ate his bandage. And so he essentially ate an entire roll of conforming, you know, the stretchy conforming gauze. We call it cling in North America. And so it's an elastic. So it had, not only was it a linear foreign body, but it was an elastic linear foreign body. So his entire intestinal tract was just, you know, you can just imagine the placations. It was great. But I think I've never had issues accessing the stomach. So if you're having trouble, you probably need to make your incision more cranial. So your skin incision can extend over the base of the xiphoid cartilage, and you can extend your linear alba incision over the xiphoid as well and remove the falciform. And then I find putting some stay sutures in the stomach really helpful before you make your gastrotomy. And then those stay sutures can pull the stomach caudally and ventrally, so upwards towards you. Mm-hmm. And then you can get some lap sponges around the stomach and pack it off. And then after that, make your gastrotomy. And yeah, like Gerardo said, a lot of these animals will have really full stomachs. And so either passing a stomach tube before you do gastrotomy and also having the suction available to you once you've done the gastrotomy, because you can expect a sort of fountain of gastric juices to come out. And I think one other thing to do with really full stomachs is these patients often are a huge aspiration risk on induction. So having like really rapid intubation and then a gastric tube at induction can be really helpful as well.
Awesome. Yeah, and that's some pretty good points there. I think one thing that people find a little bit scary is cutting to the xiphoid. Like sometimes the xiphoid's hanging out. But any tips there on how far you can cut through without all of a sudden going into the diaphragm?
No, you don't need to cut through the xiphoid. So the linear alba will extend ventral to the xiphoid. You can have your scissor between the xiphoid and the external rectus. And yeah, you can cut to the base of the xiphoid. I think if you're ventral to the xiphoid, so on top of it as you're looking down, then the xiphoid will protect you from the diaphragm. Does that make sense? So the diaphragm will attach underneath or dorsal to the xiphoid process. Gotcha. So definitely you need to be aware of the diaphragm and don't enter the chest. That's not great. But honestly, if you can put your Balfour retractor in and just visualize the stomach, then if you can get some stay sutures in the stomach is a really elastic organ. And so it's possible to use those stay sutures to put a little bit of tension on it to get it eventually and out from under the ribs where you can see it. So I don't think there should be a scenario where you can't access the stomach because the intestines are in the way. So I would still advocate for releasing the foreign body from the stomach, because otherwise you might make an extra intestinal enterotomy that you don't need to.
Yeah.
Would, depending on the viability, right, would you try to milk it a little bit orally first to see, not first, but as part of the process and see, because I've actually done a gastrotomy and been able to make one incision, remove the anchor that was stuck in a pylorus, and then able then to pull the whole thing back slowly just by kind of like milking it.
Yeah, sometimes you get lucky. So once you're in the stomach, if the material is, you know, moving really easily, and if it's very smooth material and not causing any trauma to the intestine, and if it's probably only in the duodenum, then sometimes you get lucky and you can pull it out the stomach for sure. But I would say the majority of times I would advocate, if in doubt, milk it aborally rather than risk tearing the small intestine, because it's always better to have to make an extra enterotomy than to have to do a resection and anastomosis that you hadn't planned on.
Hey, while we're on the topic of clinical content, I wanted to tell you about two events that I'll be attending and doing some live podcasting from. Both of these are organized by my friend and also regular podcast guest, Dr. Dave Collins, and his Vets on Tour conferences, where we combine learning and fun. In both these cases, it's no fun. The first one is in Wanaka in New Zealand from 12 to 16th of August. Now, if you haven't been to Wanaka, wow. Even if you don't like skiing, the hiking and the scenery is more than enough motivation to find an excuse to go there. And this conference is a pretty good excuse. This year's clinical content is focused on surgery, anesthesia, and cardiology, with stellar speakers on topics like updates on desexing, BOA surgery, anesthesia emergencies, sedation protocols, feline heart failure, arrhythmias, to name just a few. Then I'll hopefully be joining the Vets on Tour crew again in Furano in Japan on 18 to 25 of January 2025 for more snow fun, more learning and podcasting, and probably a fair amount of sake and amazing food. Dave has just confirmed that our very own Bronwyn will be one of the speakers for that event. He's also created a special Vet Vault special. If you register before the end of April for Wanaka or before the end of May for Japan, and you tell Dave that you heard about the conferences on the Vet Vault, he will give you 10% off your conference registration fee. He'll also let you choose his outfit for the notorious Vets on Tour fancy dress party. Perhaps he can wear the leather miniskirt that I wore last year. Which sounded like an hilarious idea, but not that clever if you consider that we were, after all, in cold enough weather for it to snow. So tell Dave Hubert sent you, and you'll get your 10% off. I hope to see you there. Okay, back to Bronwyn and sad guts with strings in them.
So one question, I've never started at the stomach, probably because I've never actually asked. I just sort of bumbled my own technique. I generally would start with if you have a long one that goes stomach past the duodenum and quite a way down, just beyond the duodenum, I do one releasing cut and it sort of boom, then it recoils back to the stomach and the other way around. But I love your idea. But in my head, I'm thinking, well, if you've got all that tension, you've got this thing trying to pull out of the stomach, how easy is it to actually access it or pull it far enough back through the stomach or into the stomach so that you can actually snip that? Or is it like I would worry that pulling on it is going to put even more tension on that strangulated bit of intestine. Is that a challenge or is it not? Am I making this up?
Not usually. So yeah, this is one of the big take-home messages of the podcast, I think, is to release the anchor first before you start making enterotomy. So I'm going to say it again. Maybe I'm just lucky, but I, as yet, have never had to make more than one enterotomy in a dog with a linear foreign body. So one gastrotomy, one enterotomy, foreign body's out in a dog. And I think that's because if you release it in the stomach first, then you only need to make one enterotomy. And so that, like, the number of holes in the intestine you make is directly proportional to the rate of complications. So if you can minimize the number of enterotomies, it'll minimize your surgical time, but it also minimizes your risk of dehiscence. So in the stomach, yeah, you don't want to pull the foreign body too hard. And so I'll position my gastrotomy not over the pylorus, like you don't want to put it over that muscular part of the stomach because that increases the complication rate, but just orid to the pylorus. So okay, different kind of spot to what you would do for a standard gastrotomy. Yeah. And having your stay sutures kind of towards the pylorus helps with that too. And so then I'll just lift the foreign body up enough that I can get my scissor underneath it and cut.
Right.
Okay. And sometimes I'm even cutting blind. So in the case of your tennis ball, you know, you've got your tennis ball grasped in, say, your Alice tissue forceps, and you've got your scissors in the other hand, and you just kind of snip underneath it. And then oftentimes, you know, the fluff of the tennis ball or whatever it is just disappears into the intestine, and that's fine. Off it goes. And then check the rest of the stomach, make sure there's nothing else in there, and then close the stomach so you don't have stuff spilling everywhere. And then start the milking process down the intestine. And then in most cases that have not perforated, you'll just carry on milking very, very gently down to sort of the mid jejunum or wherever the rest of the foreign body happens to be. And then at that point, pick a nice healthy spot and make one enterotomy and pull the whole thing out.
I'm almost excited for my next linear foreign body. This sounds so much easier.
Podcast done.
Glad I came.
I've got a couple of questions. One is about deciding when to resect an anastomose, but I'm sure that's that's later and later down the track. But what about kitty cats? Kitty cats, where you find it under the tongue and you just pull it, right? I'm sure that's what you just pull it out.
great idea.
Obviously not, because that was laughter there. Okay.
Yeah. So cats are a bit different. So if you have your cat that has a linear foreign body and maybe you've done a really thorough physical exam and you found the string under the tongue in your awake cat, my take would be to leave. You know that your cat's clinical, it's been vomiting, it's got this linear foreign body, so you're going to recommend surgery. So wait until surgery before cutting that string, because the difference in cats is that they tend to eat really, really thin thread-like foreign bodies, like thread with or without needles. And so that is really hard to palpate in an intestine, particularly a thickened intestine. So they're quite different to dogs in what they eat and where it's anchored. And so generally, let's say we've got the textbook cat that has a under the tongue foreign body, then we'll go into surgery, open up the abdomen, and you'll see the plicated intestines. And same thing as dogs, before we do the full explore, we're going to release the foreign body. But in cats, often what I'll do before releasing it is I will make one enterotomy at a level where I think the intestine's relatively healthy, and I'll grasp the foreign body with a little hemostat. So being really careful not to pull on the foreign body, just grasp it, and it'll be sitting there at the mesenteric border. Mm-hmm. And then once I've got hold of it, so I'm not going to lose it, then I'll get somebody, the anaesthetist or the nurse or technician helping out, to cut it under the tongue. And at that point, you'll be able to get the foreign body that was in the mouth out through that one enterotomy. And then depending on how much foreign body is left aborad to where your hemostat is grasping it, maybe you'll be able to milk it back and get it all out of that one enterotomy. But more commonly, because that thread is often embedded in the wall of the intestine, sometimes pulling on it can do more harm than good. So in those cases, if I can't get it all out, then before I release the one hemostat, I'll make a second enterotomy and grasp it at the second enterotomy, and then cut the string and pull half out from one enterotomy and half out from the other enterotomy. Does that make sense?
Sounds like you need to be who's Spider-Man's arch enemy?
Dr. Ock
or something. Let's go back to actually your first enterotomy. So let's say when you're saying you're pulling it, you're not necessarily pulling it though, but you're kind of teasing the intestine that's aboral, so towards the rectum, kind of off it, is as opposed to actually pulling it.
Yeah, so you're right. So minimal pulling. So for the first instead of a judgment call, like if I've got a cat whose entire jejunum is just completely plicated with what we think is a really thin string foreign body. And in some of these cats, honestly, the string is anchored in their mouth and some of it's dangling out their anus. Like they've literally got the string all the way through them. And so in those cats, I know that I'm going to have to make usually more than one enterotomy. So the first one will be kind of in, say, the early jejunum or the distal duodenum. And that goal of that one is just to remove the string that used to be in the mouth. So I'm mainly removing the string from ORAD to the way the hemostat is. And then the second enterotomy will be sort of mid jejunum, say, and that one we're going to grasp the string. And then we're grasping it first, because once you've cut it, and these cats, you can't feel the foreign body. So you don't want to sort of lose it and wonder, like, did I get it all out or not? You want to know where it is. So before cutting it, you'll grasp another little piece of it. And then if you're lucky, you'll be able to sort of milk the intestine over the foreign body and get it out through that second enterotomy. And if not, you'll have to make another enterotomy really small. And these enterotomies only need to be tiny, right? Like a centimeter or less long, because all we're trying to get out is tiny string.
So So I'm picturing you've got, at points you will have multiple hemostats clicked onto bits of string with small little interotomy still open. Is that, am I yes. understanding that correctly? Okay, cool.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And in cats, like my top tip for cat intestinal surgery, especially if you're by yourself, is to sterilize some bobby pins, like the kind that you put in your hair, mm-hmm. Or that some people put in their hair. And
feed that to the cat and then... And...
right. So the bobby pins act in place of Doyen forceps. So they are really atraumatic little intestinal clamps. And so rather than having multiple assistants with their fingers on the intestine to prevent spillage, you just put little bobby pins on either side of where you want to make your enterotomies.
Really? Is that not too tight?
No, it works really well. Oh, really atraumatic. So cool. I can show you a picture if you want. But yeah, that works. It works really well in cats because they've got such tiny, cute little intestines. And the nice thing about that is that often the string, it's possible to still pass the string even though you've got a bobby pin on it because the string is so tiny. So yes, you sometimes will have more than one enterotomy open in a cat, and that's why they're quite different to dogs. Like some cats eat the standard, eat different things that you can feel that are anchored in the stomach, and then those ones you just treat like a dog. But this is kind of the cat that ate the string that's gone, that's a very thin string. You might need to make multiple enterotomies.
That's brilliant, man.
Mm.
Love it. Okay, Brian, now I'm cheering because I've got my foreign body out and I think I'm a hero. And then I look at that intestinal tract and you look at that mesenteric surface and you see those little black dots every couple of centimeters. That's a tough one for me. Do you always cut those out? Do you wait and see? How do you handle those ones?
Yeah, that's a very challenging part of surgery. I think usually if you've managed to get your foreign body out without dragging it along the mesenteric border, so you've managed to do as minimal damage as possible, only if you're very, very unlucky will there be perforations or non-viable parts all along the intestine. More often, at least in dogs, there'll just be maybe one little area. And I guess the way I assess viability in those cases, if there's a perforation, even if it's just a small one, if there is a hole, it needs a resection and anastomosis. So, you know, sorry, that this needs to be done. If there's kind of purplish regions, then I guess it's really a judgment call. Usually I'll watch and see if things improve over time. So give it, you know, 10 minutes. Sometimes I'll use that time to close my enterotomy incision. I'll look at it and I think, oh, I'm not sure about this, but hey, I'll put some sutures in the enterotomy and kind of that gives me 10 minutes of waiting time. And then I'll lavage the abdomen and give it some time to reperfuse. And then I'll go back and take another look. And a lot of the time things have improved in that time, in which case, you know, good news. And especially if there's some peristalsis and colors getting better and you can sort of palpate and you don't feel any thin regions, then it's probably going to be okay. Mm-hmm. But if you've got black or gray patches or any holes, then unfortunately you have to do your resection and anastomosis.
Okay.
That's true, because some people go and they look at it and they're like, oh, there's all this stuff's bunched up, and they go, oh, how much I need to chop out first? But the first step is always relieving and removing the resection, the foreign body, in the second mm-hmm. is resection anastomosis.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll always, even in cases where it's perforated and I know I can, you know, the septic peritonitis, there's fluid in the abdomen, I think, oh, this is really bad news, I'll still release the foreign body first. So in a dog, that'll be the gastrotomy, release it from the stomach, milk it down. And then sometimes in those cases, if things are really bad and there's multiple perforations, then you know, you can remove the foreign body along with the piece of intestine. But more often I'll take out the foreign body by an enterotomy, even if it's perforated, just because it gives me a better idea of what the intestine actually looks like. Mm. And then in those cases, I won't spend time closing the enterotomy because I know that, you know, we have to do a resection anastomosis.
Yeah.
But I'll at least get the foreign body out and still give the rest of the intestine some time, because I think sometimes people, if you make a judgment call really early in your surgery, particularly if your patient's still, say, dehydrated or hypotensive, and you haven't given it time after you've taken out the foreign body to declare itself, then you might end up being a bit too aggressive with your resection and anastomosis. You know, you want to take out enough, but not too much. That's kind of where a bit of experience comes in. But I think giving it a little bit of time before making the final call of what needs to be removed is helpful.
So removing from pylorus to like ileocolic junction is not advisable. Going in the colon to the pylorus is not good.
Generally goes poorly. The bile duct would be most unhappy with that option.
Okay.
That's a half a joke, but it was a total joke. But what do you do?
It wasn't a joke. It's a discussion now about how much can you chop out.
Okay, well, answer that first. How much can you chop out before you start getting uncomfortable?
So in terms of developing short bowel syndrome, that'll happen in dogs once you start taking, well, it's sort of a rough number, but 70-75% of the small intestinal length. And especially if for some reason you need to resect the ileocecal. So I think, you know, if I'm in surgery and there's a serious issue with multiple parts of the small intestine, then I might give the owners a call and chat about that. But, okay, you know, it's short bowel syndrome, if the ileocecal junction is intact and you have a committed owner and say the duodenum is intact, so that papilla with the bile duct and the pancreatic duct, that's intact, then with a committed owner and a change in diet and some adaptation with time, those dogs can still lead a reasonable quality of life, but they'll need dietary changes, sometimes vitamin B12, cobalamin supplements, and the owners need to be prepared. But for the first, you know, month or two, the dog will probably have diarrhea as they adapt. So I would say that's rare, though. That's a rare situation, okay, where you need, yeah, to remove that much intestine. So if you're feeling like in practice you're removing 75% of the small intestine,
think again.
Sort of most of the time, then that I would say that you probably need to reassess how you're evaluating viability. But yeah, okay.
And then back to Gerardo's comment about duodenum to colon. Duodenum, if you're in there and there is a perforation in the duodenum, how do you deal with that one? I have actually had that before.
Yeah, wow. You're quite unlucky. So in those situations,
it's because I was yanking on it to try to get it out.
Yeah, because the duodenum is pretty well, because the mesoduodenum anchors the duodenum pretty well to the body wall. It's got that duodenocolic ligament caudally. It's obviously attached to the stomach cranially. So it's pretty uncommon in linear foreign bodies to get a perforation at the duodenal papilla, which is fortunate. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes it does happen. So options there, I think that's all the options involve kind of complicated surgeries.
Is that beyond the scope of this podcast?
Probably beyond the scope of the podcast, just because it involves pretty complicated rerouting procedures. But I think, you know, really, really gentle handling of the intestine is so important with linear foreign bodies. And a lot of the time, although things might look catastrophic when you get in there, maybe actually things are just kind of bruised and nothing's perforated yet. But if you start pulling on things or you're not super careful, then potentially things can make things worse and make things harder for yourself. So
I've got a question.
Mm.
So do you do two resections on anastomosis or one resection on anastomosis?
If you have two distinct and geographically separated areas of perforation. Yeah.
Yeah, tackle that one.
So it's a fairly uncommon scenario, I think. But yeah, if I had two separate areas, then I would, and there was a reasonable amount of intestine in between them, well, depending on the size of dog, but I'd be more inclined to do two separate resection anastomoses. And if you remember the way the small intestine gets its blood supply, there's the jejunal artery that's a branch of the cranial mesenteric artery that runs instead of those fan-shaped... Yep. mesenteric blood vessels. Mm-hmm. If you make sure that you're ligating the blood vessels really close to the intestine, so you're maintaining as much as possible the collateral circulation to the adjacent pieces of intestine. Does that make sense? So in those scenarios, it's helpful to have either hemoclips or a ligature rather than hand ligating, because you obviously have to do more ligations. But if you preserve the blood supply as much as you can, then you should be able to do two resection anastomoses. But if the two perforations are really close together, or it's a really big dog with a lot of intestine, then you can do them in one. So I think it's very case dependent.
Hey, I've got one more question, Bron. I once saw a colleague, and I didn't watch the whole surgery, but he had a technique where he went in, possibly in the stomach, and actually attached a little bit of rubber tubing or like something artificial and tied it onto the foreign body. Close up the hole, but big enough that you can clearly feel it. And then use that to just thread the whole thing. And I think he threaded it all the way to the colon and pulled it out.
Yeah, so that's another technique for particularly cats. So particularly foreign bodies where you can't easily feel the foreign body, and the foreign body is also small enough that it's going to make it through the intestinal tract and through the ileocecal-colic valve without too much issue. So works best for skinny, thin foreign bodies and foreign bodies that are pretty soft, so ones mm-hmm. that are not going to cause trauma. But yeah, definitely. So in those cases, you can do either a gastrotomy or an enterotomy, depending on where the foreign body is lodged. So mm-hmm. in the case of a cat under the tongue, say, you might do a gastrotomy, and then once you've grasped the string, release it from under the tongue, mm-hmm. and then yeah, tie the string to a little bit of red rubber catheter, like urinary catheter tubing, mm-hmm. and then close your gastrotomy, and then feed the catheter tubing very gently, milk it all the way down the intestinal tract. And sometimes if things are unplicating nicely, then you can get it all the way through the ileocecal-colic valve. I think the issue sometimes in cats is that the string is so firmly embedded in the wall of the intestine that it doesn't yeah. feed nicely, but certainly it's one option. And there's even a paper, I think, describing that. They call it the red rubber catheter technique. But yeah, it's another kind of trick that can be helpful for sure.
Then you've got to ask your nurse to like look under the drapes and get ready for some cat poop in the rubber catheter as you're trying to push it to the colon.
Otherwise, you just cut into the colon and pull it out. Yes?
Oh, yes.
You, have you not listened to any of my podcasts? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I thought of one other thing I wanted to touch on, and that was just briefly the post-op care for linear foreign bodies. So I'm not sure if you've noticed this, Gerardo, but linear foreign bodies usually are sicker than standard foreign bodies. And after surgery, because their intestine has been so, you know, it's really gone through the ringer, it's been bunched up, and then oftentimes they've also had a resection anastomosis, the poor old myenteric plexus has been thoroughly confused. And so all those normal nerve impulses that would travel down the intestine causing peristalsis have been temporarily switched off. And so the patients will have really wicked ileus after surgery. Mm. And so for yeah. these guys, I love putting a nasogastric tube in them for after surgery. So that means that we can suction residual nasty fluid out of the stomach and we can start feeding them from day one, because many of them, most I would say, would not eat straight after surgery. And then also putting them on a prokinetic like metoclopramide straight after surgery. So more aggressively treating them medically in the post-op period, because it would be the exception rather than the rule that a patient with a linear foreign body would just wake up the next morning and have a full breakfast. That would be unusual, I would say.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bronwyn. That's full of pearls of wisdom. They make a pearl necklace. Bron, thank you so much. That's epic. And I can't wait for the next one.
Hey, guys. Just a quick reminder about our specialist support space. We do a lot of clinical teaching on the podcast, but I still find, despite all the stuff I've learned, that every now and again, I get stuck with a case where I just need a little bit of help from somebody with more experience or more brains than me. So these are the cases that I can't refer or I don't necessarily want to refer. I just need a little bit of extra help to get me over my sticking point. So we've created an online space where you have direct access to our team of specialists, which currently include medicine specialists, an emergency critical care specialist, an oncologist, somebody who specializes specifically in diabetes and dermatology. It is a paid space so that our specialists get paid for their time, but we've tried to keep it really affordable at around $15 a month. So if you can use a little bit of help every now and again, go and check out this space. I've put a link for you in our show description wherever you're listening to this.